Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The Endless War, a movie released in late July 2007, written, directed, and produced by Charles Ferguson, depicts the blunders and ill-prepared manner in which the United States initiated and carried out the war against Iraq. This full-length feature film juxtaposes the statements and actions of the Washington leadership of the war with the leadership's actions and grievous consequences that followed. Decisions which, at the outset, failed to include President Bush, the commander-in-chief, causing one to wonder who was in charge. Charles Ferguson holds a Ph.D. in political science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has extensive experience in foreign policy analysis and lives and works in the San Francisco Bay Area. When I spoke with him on July 20th, 2007, we began with his explanation of how the war and the occupation of Iraq were shaped by an extremely small group of people in Washington, D.C., with limited foreign policy and post-war occupation experience.
Well, the war and even more importantly, I think the occupation were shaped by the decisions of an extremely small number of people. One could argue a maximum of five people were really responsible for all of the principal decisions, both with regard to the war and with regard to the occupation.
Who are those five?
They are the Vice President, Dick Cheney, the then Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, the then Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas Feith, and the administrator of the CPA, Ambassador L. Paul Bremer.
And the CPA is?
The CPA was the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the organization that ran occupied Iraq for the first year after the war.
In identifying those five people, you've left out the commander-in-chief, President Bush.
That's correct. President Bush does not seem to have been involved in, heavily involved in, or a major participant in the critical decision-making.
That's in direct contradiction to the face that he presents on national television in his speeches.
Yes, it is, but it's true. He has recently become much more actively involved, and now I think he is, in fact, for better and or worse, firmly in command of American policy in Iraq. But in the run-up to the war and for at least the first year after the war, the first year, the critical first year of the occupation, he seems to have been astonishingly disengaged, not knowledgeable, did not read national intelligence estimates, asked very few questions, did not participate in many of the critical decisions.
When you say he's in command of the American policy in Iraq, how would you characterize that policy?
I would characterize that policy now as a desperate hope to contain a worsening situation and to reverse or compensate for a 2 or 3 year long series of disastrous decisions.
Can you tell us how the situation that you characterize has evolved or devolved?
When American forces arrived in Iraq, occupied Iraq, deposed Saddam Hussein, Iraq was already a very, very troubled place. It had lived under a brutal, quasi-genocidal dictatorship since 1979 when Saddam Hussein came to power. It had lived under extremely draconian economic sanctions since 1993. When I arrived in Iraq myself in 2006, my interpreter was formerly an emergency room doctor. And as an emergency room doctor in 2003, he earned $7 a month. By the time American forces arrived in Iraq, it was a desperately poor, very troubled, very, very troubled society in many ways, economically, socially, politically. Already there was going to be a lot of work to do and a difficult situation to manage. A series of critical American policy decisions in 2003 made the situation dramatically worse by essentially destroying and removing what little administrative, organizational, and security capacity Iraq and its government still had.
What were those policy decisions that made it worse?
The first critical one probably was not using enough troops, a decision made even before the war. Then, during the war, even before American forces reached Baghdad, it became immediately apparent that looting was going to be a major problem. Looting started almost instantly when American forces entered Iraq, and as they progressed through Iraq, at each point, as soon as Iraqi forces had been forced out or had surrendered or had been defeated, looting started, massive looting started. And then when American forces took over Baghdad, the looting assumed just extraordinary, uncontrollable proportions and destroyed a high fraction of Baghdad's and Iraq's physical infrastructure. Then, a month after that, L. Paul Bremer, in his ninth day at work, before he had even been to Iraq for the first time, together with a small number of senior administration officials who controlled Iraq policy, made three disastrous decisions. He instituted a long-term American occupation instead of making provisions for the restoration of a sovereign Iraqi government. He purged the Iraqi government of an estimated 40 to 50,000 senior administrators and technocrats, which crippled the administrative and economic and governmental capacity of the country. And most disastrously of all, he disbanded the Iraqi military and intelligence services, which threw 500,000 armed men out into the street unemployed with no severance pay.
Do you think that there was an intention, or are we just talking about haphazard and random behavior on the part of the American government towards Iraq during this time period?
I think it was a combination of the two. I think that there was an extraordinary amount of arrogance and sense that, you know, we own the place, we can do anything we want. And then together with that, there was very rigid ideology. We know what's best, and what's best is to make this place like America. And if we do that, then everybody will suddenly be happy, and everybody will realize, you know, how great our system is. And there was just an extraordinary unwillingness to listen. People on the ground in Iraq were not consulted. The rest of the United States government was not consulted. When people spoke up, many people did speak up when they saw what was happening and said, you know, this is dangerous, this is crazy, you have to stop this. They were uniformly disregarded.
The concept of making Iraq like America would impose what we know as the American culture on an entirely different culture that has roots and backgrounds that are, to use a common word, very foreign to the American culture. Where do you think the thinking comes from to impose the American culture on Iraq?
That's hard to say. In part, it came from perhaps the fact that, surprising as it may seem, these were not terribly worldly or experienced men in a number of senses. With the exception of Donald Rumsfeld, who had been a Navy pilot in the 1950s, none of them had ever served in the military. None of them had ever lived extensively in the Mideast. In fact, only L. Paul Bremer had ever lived extensively outside the United States. They don't speak foreign languages. None of them speak Arabic. They are relatively narrow people. And they also, by the way, critically importantly, I think, they also lacked experience in post-war, post-conflict situations. They didn't know what a society was like when it was under occupation, after it had been through a war, when it was necessary to maintain order and reconstruct its government systems.
Cumulatively, and of what you've just said, and applying that characterization to L. Paul Bremer, do you feel that his reasons regarding the American occupation, purging the government of administrative and technical officials and disbanding the army, was that an intentional act on his part, or was it just pulled out of thin air, or maybe somewhere in between?
Well, it was certainly intentional in the sense that, you know, he knew perfectly well what he was doing. I don't think that he knew what the consequences of it would be. He still denies that it had those consequences. He's still living in a kind of intellectual fantasy land. But he certainly knew in some literal sense what he was doing. His motivation in the case of the de-Ba'athification order, the purging of the Iraqi government, was to remove people who had any sympathy with Saddam or his ideology, his clique, the ruling clique in Iraq. He seems to have thought that it was kind of like denazification in Germany after World War II, when in fact, however, denazification took place in a very different way than what Bremer did. And also, by the way, the occupying force in Germany after World War II was 1.5 million American soldiers.
When you say the de-Ba'athification order, can you explain what that means?
Saddam rose to power through a political party called the Ba'ath Party, which was, and to some extent still is, a secular, somewhat socialist, pan-Arabic political party. So there's a Ba'ath Party in Syria as well as in Iraq. And its ideology is basically very strong government, very strong military, Arab unification, rejection of foreigners, and interestingly, it's anti-religious. It's secular, and it regards Islam, especially fundamentalist Islam, as dangerous. And fundamentalist Islam, for most of Saddam's time in power, was repressed. But it became, the Ba'ath Party, especially in Iraq under Saddam, it became very much like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or the Nazi Party under Hitler. It became an authoritarian tool of extreme power and repression. So it certainly was legitimate to want to remove from the government the people who had really been in charge of the Ba'ath Party and had really been committed to it and had really been committed to Saddam Hussein. But that should have meant removing the top maybe 500 people from the government, not 50,000 people, including the people who made Baghdad work and made sure that bridges didn't fall down and things like that.
In other words, keep the country going without regard to maintaining the policymakers, get the policymakers out of position, but keep the workers in place.
Well, workers and professionals and administrators, even policymakers in many cases, were people who joined the Ba'ath Party simply to survive, because if you didn't, you'd be shot.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Charles Ferguson, the writer, director, and producer of the movie No End in Sight, a movie which is the first film of its kind to chronicle the reasons behind Iraq's descent into guerrilla war, warlord rule, criminality, and anarchy. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Charles Ferguson, in the movie No End in Sight, you identify a series of people who you characterize as trying to save Iraq and trying to save America.
I do. There was a remarkable group of people, even before the war and well into the occupation of Iraq, who tried extremely hard to make this work. And many of them, by the way, had been opposed to the war, but and didn't think that it was necessary or in America's national interest to use military force to remove Saddam. But they thought that if the war and the occupation were conducted intelligently, that still, good things could come of this. And they tried extraordinarily hard, with great patriotism and great, in many cases, great personal sacrifice to make this work. But they were not listened to, and in many cases, they were purged from the government.
Who were those people?
Many people from many walks of life in many parts of the government and many professions. They range from senior people in the military. General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, warned 1 month before the war in Congress that several hundred thousand troops would be required for an occupation of Iraq. And he was immediately publicly contradicted by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz. And a week later, Secretary Rumsfeld announced his replacement. That sort of thing happened again and again and again. There had been a large State Department study of how to manage Iraq after removing Saddam called the Future of Iraq Project, 18-month-long project, 13 volumes of reports, 2,000 pages, hundreds of people involved in it. And Defense Secretary Rumsfeld ordered the first administrator of Iraq, Jay Garner, not to employ anyone who had been involved in that project.
And some of the others?
Colonel Paul Hughes, who was director of strategic policy for the occupation, an Army colonel who had been doing military strategy work for several years at the Pentagon, including work on Iraq, who found himself almost by accident in charge of recalling the Iraqi army because the people supposed to be in charge of the Iraqi army hadn't showed up in Baghdad yet and didn't show up, in fact, until mid-June, and who found his efforts to his utter astonishment. He had no prior indication this was going to happen. He was completely stunned when he learned of it, which was by watching the announcement on television. To his astonishment, he found that L. Paul Bremer had dissolved the Iraqi army without even consulting him.
How were you able to get access to this group of people?
A lot of hard work was certainly part of it. In many cases, it helped that I had a background in policy analysis. I got a doctorate in political science at MIT a long time ago, but I did it. And my PhD thesis advisor, who's a remarkable man by the name of Carl Kazin, had been deputy national security advisor under President Kennedy. Because of Carl and because of my own work, I was fairly well acquainted with the foreign policy community in the United States, and my credentials and the people I knew helped get me access to the critical people with regard to these issues.
Do you feel that the people who you interview in No End in Sight put themselves at risk by being in your movie?
At this point, I think not. Well, the Americans, at this point, I think not, because I think that the political mood of the country and also, of course, the composition of Congress has changed so dramatically since 2003-2004 that I think that any attempt to hurt them would rebound against the administration fairly dramatically and fairly immediately. So that I'm not too worried about. I am. A few of the people I interview in the film and a couple of the people who appear in the film are still active duty military personnel. One of them in particular, Lieutenant, when I interviewed him, now Captain Seth Moulton, says some very direct things about occupation policy, and he's now back in Iraq. And I worry about him a little bit, but he says that he's comfortable with his situation. He's working for General Petraeus. And I would say that I'm more concerned about some of the Iraqis. Omar Fekeke, who appears in the film with his face masked, but you can still hear his voice and you can still see his outline. Omar Fekeke initially decided that he was going to leave Iraq for good, but then found that he just couldn't do that. His conscience wouldn't let him. And he's now again working for the Washington Post while also being a journalism student in the United States. When he finishes journalism school, he plans to go back to Iraq and start a newspaper, and I certainly worry about him. My translator, interpreter, who doesn't appear in the film, was afraid to be filmed. He's lost 13 family members who've been kidnapped or killed since 2003. 13. Most recently, a few weeks ago, his father was kidnapped and killed by the Mahdi Army.
Sounds terrible.
It is.
Sounds terrible. Tell us about how the events of September 11th, 2001, figure into the attack on Iraq, or don't figure in.
Well, they clearly do figure in to some extent in some way. Exactly how, I don't know if we'll ever know. We'd have to get inside the minds of the people who ran this war and ran this administration. Clearly, it made it politically much easier for them to do this. Did it have an effect on how much they wanted to do it? It seems to have. Right. I don't doubt the sincerity of Dick Cheney's feeling that any risk of terrorism, no matter how slight, needs to be dealt with extremely forcefully. I would tend to think that he really believed that.
Do you believe that?
It depends what you mean by forcefully. No is the simple answer, because if you just deal with things forcefully, there's a major risk that you'll create a problem even larger than the initial problem that you're faced with. Force is not always the right way to deal with a long-term political problem. I certainly agree that Saddam Hussein and Iraq were a problem. How much of a terrorism risk they were is not clear. I think that the risk that they presented with regard to terrorism was greatly exaggerated by the administration, probably knowingly, although they may also have believed that he was more of a risk than he actually was. But there's no question that Saddam Hussein was not a nice man. And before the war, I was actually somewhat sympathetic to the idea of using military force to remove him. But I certainly would have felt that if that was to be done, that it had to be done in a dramatically different way.
What way would that have been?
Much more international involvement, much more UN involvement, and perhaps most importantly, with an understanding that this was a troubled society and very troubled nation, and you couldn't go in and decide that you were going to turn it into America overnight, that you had to be very careful in how you proceeded and make sure that you maintained as much law and order and administrative capacity and economic capacity as you possibly could.
In addition to what you just said, are there ways other than military force that you would recommend or feel appropriate in this kind of circumstance?
In the general circumstance of dealing with a difficult country, yes, I think diplomacy should be used much more than this administration feels that it needs to be. In the particular case of Saddam Hussein, I have to say, diplomacy didn't get you very far. Saddam was a brutal, quasi-psychotic, quasi-genocidal, authoritarian, utterly ruthless dictator. And he showed that in many, many ways. He started three wars that killed almost 2 million people. He killed 250,000 of his own citizens. He used poison gas against his own citizens. He tried to assassinate the first President Bush in 1993. Saddam Hussein was not a nice guy. And there are times when sometimes military force might be required. I think, you know, reasonable people can disagree about whether it was necessary or beneficial to use military force against Saddam. I think there are reasonable arguments on both sides. But what I principally tried to show in this film is that if you are going to go to war, you have to do it intelligently and carefully. If you go to war casually and arrogantly and sloppily, horrific problems will result.
Charles Ferguson, you had a personal bodyguard when you prepared and filmed No End in Sight. What were your personal feelings or your emotions as your work evolved?
Well, it was a tremendously emotional experience, as you can imagine, I'm sure, both in the United States and in Iraq for different reasons. I'm a human being, of course, those emotions affected me. I tried, when I was making the film, to put them aside, you know, and I think that my training as a policy analyst earlier helped me do that, because I think that actually this war and this occupation are an example of what happens when you let either ideology or emotions get in the way of thinking objectively and having an open mind. So I tried to keep my emotions out of the film, but that's not to say that I didn't have them. And you know, you see and hear things in both in America when you're talking with people who were involved in these policies and these problems, and also in Iraq when you talk with people who have to live with their consequences, that really sometimes break your heart.
What can the average person who sees your film do to see that this won't happen again?
Yes, well, the next time somebody tells you that America has to invade a country, I think you should look very, very carefully at how well that war is being planned and whether people are thinking carefully about what comes after.
Well, we don't really know. We know after the fact how well it was planned, and comparing it to Kennedy's advisor, Carl Kaysen, your PhD advisor, it seems like during the Kennedy era, there was a whole lot more intellectual participation in foreign policy than there is in the Bush era.
Well, there was just intellectual, yes, but just broader. People were listened to. People in the military, people in the intelligence community, people in the State Department, academic specialists, other nations, diplomats were listened to. And that's important. You're absolutely right that this war and occupation were planned in great secrecy and the American people couldn't see much. But that should have been a warning sign. I have to say that I think the media and the American people, to some extent, gave the administration a free ride during this period, did not ask, you know, why don't we know anything about what's going on here, and why aren't more questions being asked and more people being consulted?
Well, Charles Ferguson, writer, director, and producer of the movie No End in Sight, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting movie or book that you've seen or read lately?
Well, I recently saw a remarkable film, a German film, called The Lives of Others, which was made by a West German who has a background actually similar to mine. He studied politics in London. And it's about East Germany under the communist regime. And it's about this kind of duel of wits and gradual relationship that forms between a member of the East German secret police and an East German artist. And it's an amazing, amazing exploration of the personal, emotional consequences of an authoritarian government. And it reminded me a lot of things I saw in Iraq.
Charles Ferguson, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Ferguson is the writer, director, and producer of the full-length feature film The Endless War, released in late July 2007. The film he recommends is The Lives of Others, a story about East Germany under the communist regime. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.